I want you to imagine, just for a moment, that you are standing outside on a completely clear, completely dark night. You look up at the sky, you know, past the clouds, past the atmosphere, and you're just staring into the deep void of space. Endless stars, galaxies spinning in silence, this ancient cosmic machine governed by strict cold mathematics.
Exactly, the grand scale of it all.
Yeah. And now I want you to take that vast mechanical image and bring your focus all the way back down to Earth. Like, bring it inside yourself.
Because zooming way in.
Right. Think about the wet, messy chemical biology inside your own head. The neurons firing, the salty fluids rushing around, the sheer biological chaos that somehow produces your thoughts, your feelings, your consciousness.
It's quite a contrast.
It is. And usually when we look at those two domains, the cold cosmos and the wet brain, we see two entirely different realities, you know, governed by two entirely different rule books.
Well, it is the ultimate dichotomy in human understanding. I mean, we have built our entire scientific worldview on that exact separation.
We really have.
We just assume that biology is, you know, a highly complex accident of chemistry, and the universe is just a massive, unthinking container where that accident happened to take
And
place.
that is exactly how I've always thought about it. The universe is the stage, and we are just these weird temporary actors made of meat.
Right, meat computers.
Yeah. But the deep dive we are taking today is going to completely shatter that separation.
Welcome to the Deep Dive, everyone. I'm your host, and I'm sitting here with our resident expert. And today, we are looking at a stack of research that forces us to ask a truly staggering question.
It really is staggering. Glad to be here, by the way.
Always great to have you. So, the question we're exploring is this: what if the human brain and the cosmos itself run on the exact same operating system?
Yeah, what if those two rule books are actually just one?
It's wild. So, what is our mission today? Like, what are we actually looking at?
Well, it's a profound shift in perspective. And we are not talking about abstract philosophy here. We are looking at hard empirical data today.
Real science. Exactly. We are going to explore recent breakthroughs in quantum neurobiology that prove our brains are doing things physics previously thought were literally impossible.
Right.
And we are going to look at the current undeniable crisis in astrophysics, where our absolute best models of gravity in the universe are, well, they're breaking down under the weight of new telescope data.
Which is just crazy to think about.
It is. And we're going to synthesize all of this by looking at a radical framework that attempts to rewrite the source code of reality itself.
A model that suggests human consciousness isn't just some, you know, random biological byproduct, but a fundamental structural force woven into the geometric fabric of space and time.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this, because to understand the entire universe, we actually have to zoom all the way in first. I mean, microscopic, straight into the water and the proteins inside your own head.
We have to start with the fundamental question of how the brain communicates with itself. For over a century, the classical view in neuroscience, the foundation of every biology textbook, really is that the brain operates like a complex biological telegraph system.
Yeah, the whole electrical spikes and chemical synapses thing. You have a neuron, it builds up an electrical charge, it fires a spike down its wire, and then it squirts out some chemicals, right?
Neurotransmitters.
Right, like dopamine or serotonin to trigger the next neuron. It's basically a chemical and electrical relay race.
Precisely. Action potentials and neurotransmitters. And while that classical view is true, and it does happen, a groundbreaking new paper titled Fractal Resonance in Brain Structures proves that this classical model is desperately incomplete.
Okay, how so?
Well, it is like looking at a modern smartphone and thinking it only works by physical buttons being pressed, completely ignoring the invisible Wi-Fi and cellular data networks transmitting information wirelessly through the air.
Oh, I love that analogy, because what these researchers discovered is essentially the brain's hidden wireless network. They found that the physical structural components inside our brain cells, like the scaffolding itself, isn't just dead material holding the cell together. These structures act as literal electromagnetic antennas.
Right, they vibrate, they resonate, they actively receive and transmit electromagnetic frequencies.
That is insane.
And to understand how revolutionary this is, we need to look at the three specific biological scales the researchers investigated. The foundational building block they looked at is a protein called tubulin.
Wait, I need to get a sense of scale here because the sizes in this paper are just mind-boggling. How small are we talking when we say tubulin?
We are talking about a single individual protein molecule. It is roughly 4 nanometers wide.
4 nanometers.
Yeah. To put that in perspective, a single strand of your DNA is about 2.5 nanometers wide.
Oh, wow.
So a tubulin protein is incredibly tiny, operating on the absolute frontier of the quantum realm.
Okay, so a 4-nanometer protein, that is scale number one.
Correct. Now, for scale number two, biology takes thousands of these tiny tubulin proteins and stacks them together tightly, almost like bricks in a chimney.
Okay.
And that forms a hollow tube. This structure is called a microtubule.
A microtubule, right.
Yeah, and it is about 25 nanometers wide, and it acts as the structural skeleton and the transport highway inside the cell.
So the tubulin is the individual brick, and the microtubule is the hollow chimney made out of those bricks.
That's a great way to picture it.
And then for the third scale, we zoom way, way out to the neuron itself, specifically the axon, which is the long cable that the neuron uses to send those classical electrical spikes.
Yes, and that entire axon cable is absolutely packed with bundles of these microtubules. The axon itself is about 1 micrometer wide.
Okay, let me make sure I'm following.
Sure.
So if we trace this up, we go from a 4-nanometer protein to a 25-nanometer microtubule to a 1-micrometer cellular cable.
Right. It is a million-fold leap in scale from the smallest piece to the largest.
Which makes what they found next completely insane to me. Because when they pumped alternating current or, you know, AC electromagnetic signals into these biomaterials, you would think biological tissue would just passively resist the current.
Right, like an insulator.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you run electricity through a wet piece of string, it just acts like a dumb resistor.
And that is what the classical models predicted. Biological tissue should act as an insulator, creating a messy, random dissipation of energy.
But that is not what happened.
No, it wasn't. These structures resonated. They actively absorbed and transmitted the energy at highly specific quantized frequencies.
And not just random frequencies either. They discovered this complex mathematical pattern, which they called a triplet of triplet fractal pattern?
Yes, the triplet fractal pattern.
So think of it like Russian nesting dolls, but made out of vibrational frequencies. So you have a main band of resonance. But if you look closely inside that main band, it's actually made up of 3 smaller frequency bands. And if you zoom in on each of those 3 smaller bands, you find 3 even smaller bands perfectly nested inside.
It's beautiful, really. The geometry of the resonance is perfectly mathematically nested. But the most staggering part of this discovery, the part that fundamentally rewrites our understanding of neurobiology, is that this identical pattern exists across all 3 of those vastly different biological scales.
This is the part that I had to read 3 times to fully grasp.
It's a lot to take in.
It really is. So you have the tiny tubulin protein, right, because it's so small. It vibrates incredibly fast up in the terahertz and gigahertz range.
Right.
Then you have the larger microtubule chimney. Because it's bigger, it vibrates slower down in the megahertz range.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you have the massive neuron cable, which vibrates even slower down in the kilohertz range.
Yes. Completely different sizes, completely different speeds of vibration.
But despite that, their vibrational blueprints are mathematically identical. The exact same triplet of triplet pattern. It's like a massive biological choir. You have the sopranos singing incredibly high and fast, the altos in the middle, and the basses singing low and slow. But they aren't singing random notes. They are all singing the exact same complex mathematical song, just scaled perfectly across different octaves.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it.
Yeah.
The resonance is entirely scale-free. The researchers suggest that these incredibly fast, tiny quantum vibrations in the terahertz range within the individual proteins actually integrate and basically add up.
They cascade.
Yes, they cascade upward through the fractal architecture to eventually trigger the slower, larger kilohertz electrical spikes of the whole neuron.
Wow.
So the classical chemical firing of the brain is just the final, slow, macro result of a staggeringly fast underlying quantum symphony.
Hold on, I'm struggling with this, and I know anyone who has studied physics is screaming right now.
Oh, I'm sure they are.
Because for decades, physicists have flat out laughed at the idea of the brain having any functioning quantum states. They always use the phrase, what is it? Warm, wet, and noisy.
Yes, warm, wet, and noisy.
Right. Because to build a quantum computer in a lab, we have to isolate the processors in giant, super-cooled vacuums at absolute zero. Mm. Otherwise, the ambient heat and radiation of the room destroys the delicate quantum entanglement. It's called decoherence. So how on earth are they claiming that highly ordered quantum vibrations are surviving inside 98-degree salty biological fluid inside our heads?
Your pushback is entirely justified.
Yeah.
And frankly, that assumption that biology is too warm and messy for quantum mechanics is exactly why this remained undiscovered for nearly a century.
Really?
Yes. Whenever scientists previously tried to measure the electrical properties of these proteins, they were measuring them floating in standard biological fluid, which is essentially salty water.
Right. Our brains are mostly water-packed with sodium and potassium ions.
Exactly. And those charged ions in the water completely masked the true properties of the proteins. It created a massive amount of biological static.
Oh, so they couldn't even see the signal.
No, the water absorbed the signals, hiding the delicate resonance of the microtubules. So to solve this, the researchers couldn't just use standard microscopic electrodes. They had to invent an astonishing piece of technology called the atomic coaxial probe.
Which sounds like something straight out of a sci-fi movie. A needle that ends in a single atom.
It is an engineering marvel. It is an atomic resolution probe surrounded by a specialized insulated cylinder.
Okay.
This needle is so unimaginably sharp that it can penetrate deep into a living cell, bypass all that noisy, salty fluid, and directly touch a single microtubule structure without destroying it.
That is wild. So they basically built a microscopic wiretap that filters out the noise of the ocean just to listen to a single fish.
Precisely. By physically bypassing that fluid environment, they isolated the pure electromagnetic vibrations of the proteins themselves.
Yeah.
And when they did, they mapped out these 3D frequency wheels.
Yeah.
They could see exactly how the proteins process signals.
And it proved that microtubules are not just structural scaffolding holding up the walls of the cell. They are actively processing complex information.
Yes.
The researchers did this test where they sent non-coherent, messy, random AC signals into a microtubule. And the microtubule didn't just pass the mess along, right? It naturally cleaned it. It synchronized the chaotic signal into a quantized phase modulation.
Which means it is acting as an insulated quantum processor and a wireless antenna simultaneously.
Wow.
The proteins are literally beaming and receiving complex structured frequencies wirelessly to one another long before the cell ever decides to fire a classical chemical signal.
Okay, so that establishes that the microscopic structure of the brain acts as a fractal antenna network. But, I mean, acknowledging that proteins vibrate in a cool math pattern is one thing. Proving that actual quantum entanglement, that spooky connection, where two particles share a state regardless of distance, is happening inside a conscious human brain.
That is a much bigger claim.
It's a massive leap. That requires an entirely different kind of proof, right?
It does. It requires moving from isolated proteins in a petri dish to a living, breathing, thinking human being.
Right.
Which leads us perfectly into the next major breakthrough. We need to discuss a paper titled Experimental Indications of Non-Classical Brain Functions. These researchers decided to tackle that exact warm, wet, and noisy problem head-on in living humans.
Okay, and how did they do that?
They did it by essentially hacking a standard MRI machine.
See, I was fascinated by the methodology of this experiment, because you can't just point a Geiger counter or a camera at a thought and measure its quantumness, you know?
Where you can't see entanglement.
Exactly. So how did they actually prove it?
They utilized a theoretical framework borrowed from quantum gravity research called the mediator concept.
Okay, let me see if I can explain the mediator concept with an analogy, and you tell me if I'm tracking this correctly.
Go for it.
Imagine you have two people, person A and person B. They are sitting completely blindfolded in separate, entirely soundproof rooms on opposite sides of a building.
Okay.
Suddenly, they both raise their left hands at the exact same millisecond. Since they absolutely cannot see or hear each other, and we know it's not a coincidence, something invisible must be connecting them.
Right.
So in physics, if you can prove that system A and system B have become perfectly synchronized or quantumly entangled, then whatever invisible thing connected them, the mediator, must also be a quantum system.
That is an excellent way to visualize it. If classical physics cannot explain the connection, the mediator must be non-classical or quantum.
Okay, so how does this apply to the brain?
In this MRI experiment, the blindfolded people, system A and system B, were the nuclear spins of protons in the water fluid of the brain. Now, MRI machines are specifically designed to measure the behavior of water protons.
Because our brains are full of water, and the MRI magnets can make those water protons spin and broadcast a signal, right?
Correct. So the researchers posed a specific question. Can we prove that these water protons in different areas of the brain are becoming quantumly entangled?
Right.
Because if they're entangled, the mediator, which in this case is the brain's internal computational process, must inherently be a quantum system.
But to do this, they couldn't just use the MRI normally, could they?
No, they couldn't.
Because a normal MRI uses its magnetic fields to measure the loud classical state of water. It measures something called single quantum coherence, or SQC. What exactly is SQC?
Think of single quantum coherence like watching a giant synchronized swimming team from a distance. You are seeing the macroscopic average movement of all the swimmers moving together as a bulk group. That is the loud classical signal that normal MRIs look at to take pictures of your brain tissue.
Got it.
But these researchers were not interested in the bulk movement. They were looking for the subtle, hidden quantum relationships between individual particles, which is called zero quantum coherence, or ZQC.
So using the synchronized swimming analogy, ZQC isn't about the whole team moving together. It's about looking at the hidden, invisible mathematical relationship between two specific swimmers, even when the whole team is acting chaotic.
Exactly. And that subtle ZQC signal is usually completely drowned out by the loud screaming SQC signal. It's
Yeah.
like trying to hear a whisper at a heavy metal concert.
Right.
So the researchers had to hack the MRI. They pulsed the magnetic fields in a highly specific, customized sequence designed to saturate or completely mute the loud classical signal.
They basically turned off the stadium lights so they could see the glow-in-the-dark stars.
Yes, that's exactly it. They silenced the classical noise. And when they did this and scanned the brains of 40 volunteers who were just resting in the machine, the discoveries were revolutionary.
What did they see?
In the darkness of that silenced classical noise, they found hidden quantum correlations, zero quantum coherence flashing in the brain fluid. And these flashes were rhythmically synchronized with the subject's heartbeats.
Wow.
This is a phenomenon known as heartbeat-evoked potentials.
Now, obviously, a skeptic, and I try to always put my skeptic hat on here, is going to immediately point out the elephant in the room.
Of course.
They would say, well, obviously, it's pulsing with the heartbeat. The heart pumps blood. Blood rushes into the brain, and the moving fluid disrupts the magnetic signal. How do they know they weren't just measuring blood flowing around?
That is exactly the first thing the peer reviewers asked, and the researchers rigorously controlled for it. They introduced a CO2 challenge. They had the subjects hyperventilate or hold their breath while in the scanner. Holding your breath drastically alters the normal blood flow and oxygenation levels in the brain.
Okay, so if the signal was just blood moving, holding their breath should change the signal.
Exactly. And when they checked the normal classical MRI signal, the SQC, it changed exactly as you would expect with altered blood flow.
Right.
But the hidden rhythmic quantum signal, the ZQC, it didn't change at all. It remained perfectly stable regardless of the blood flow alterations.
That's incredible.
The researchers spent months analyzing the fluid dynamics and different magnetic gradient angles, and they proved mathematically that this specific ZQC signal could not be explained by classical physics like moving blood, pulsating tissue, or standard fluid dynamics. It was a pure non-classical entanglement signal.
But here's where it gets really interesting. This is the part that literally gave me goosebumps when I read it. The consciousness switch.
Ah, yes, the sleep factor.
Right. During these 20-minute MRI scans, the subjects were just lying there in the dark, and naturally, some of them drifted off and fell
It
asleep.
happens in long MRI studies all the time.
But when they looked at the data, they saw something impossible. The exact moment the volunteers fell asleep and lost conscious awareness, that rhythmic, heartbeat-evoked quantum signal completely faded
You
away.
vanished.
It just vanished. And when the subjects woke back up, the quantum signal instantly returned. The signal wasn't just a biological baseline. It was entirely 100% dependent on conscious awareness.
This observation is profound. It provides experimental weight to what has historically been one of the most controversial, heavily debated theories in the history of neuroscience, the orchestrated objective reduction theory, or OTRPR.
Right, proposed back in the 1990s by Nobel laureate physicist Sir Roger Penrose and anesthesiologist Dr. Stuart Hameroff.
Exactly.
I want to pause on this for a second because the history here is wild. For 30 years, mainstream science absolutely mocked Penrose and Hameroff for suggesting the brain was a quantum computer.
They faced intense skepticism.
People thought they were crazy for suggesting that consciousness wasn't just chemicals, but a fundamental quantum process. But OTRPR argues exactly what these two papers we just discussed have now proven, right?
It really does.
That consciousness is a quantum phenomenon, and the actual hardware processing these thoughts are those tiny microtubule antennas inside our neurons.
It is a massive vindication for them. If we synthesize these first two sources, the implications change how we view human biology entirely. It provides hard, empirical data supporting the theory that consciousness is fundamentally a quantum state, not just a byproduct of classical chemistry.
It's a paradigm shift.
And furthermore, it explains one of the greatest biological mysteries of all time, energy efficiency.
Right. The human brain runs on about 20 watts of power. That is roughly the energy required to power a dim refrigerator light bulb.
Nothing.
Yet with those 20 watts, your brain vastly outperforms our most advanced energy-guzzling supercomputers that require entire power plants to run.
The math of the classical chemical brain could never explain that computational efficiency. But if the brain is actually functioning as a massive fractal quantum computer, utilizing entangled states within millions of microtubule antennas simultaneously, well, its processing power is exponentially higher than classical models previously thought possible.
It explains the 20-watt miracle perfectly.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's summarize where we are. The microscopic structure of our mind isn't a telegraph wire. It is a fractal quantum computer acting as a highly tuned antenna.
Mm-hmm.
But if your brain is an antenna, what exactly is it plugging into? What is the signal it's receiving? If it's a quantum receiver, what is the quantum transmitter?
That is the ultimate question.
To answer that, we have to flip the microscope into a telescope. We have to scale all the way up from the 25 nanometer microtubule to the grand architecture of the universe itself. Which brings us to the massive crisis happening right now in cosmology, detailed in the 500-page update from the Cantata Network.
Yes. The paper titled Modified Gravity in Cosmology, an update by the Cantata Network. To truly understand why hundreds of top European physicists, mathematicians, and astronomers came together to write this exhaustive report, you have to understand the panic currently simmering in the astrophysics community.
Panic is a strong word, but it fits.
The current standard model of physics is breaking down under the weight of new, ultra-precise telescope data.
And we're talking about the big ones here. Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity and the standard model of cosmology, which physicists call lambda CDM. Now, to be fair, Einstein has had an incredible run.
An unprecedented run.
General relativity is beautiful math. It predicts planetary orbits. It predicted the existence of black holes long before we ever photographed one. It predicts the expansion of the universe. But the cracks in the foundation are getting too severe to ignore.
The most glaring foundational crack is physics' total reliance on what they call the dark sector. To make Einstein's equations of general relativity actually work at cosmic scales, to explain why spinning galaxies don't just fly apart from centrifugal force, physicists had to invent something called dark matter.
Because according to the math of standard gravity, there isn't enough visible stuff like stars, planets, gas to hold a galaxy together. It should shred itself apart. So they said, well, there must be invisible matter providing extra gravity.
Correct. And furthermore, to explain why the expansion of the universe is actively accelerating instead of slowing down, they had to invent a mysterious repulsive force called dark energy.
And we've never actually seen either of these, right?
We have been searching for decades, spending billions of dollars on underground detectors and colliders, and we have never directly detected either of these things in a laboratory. They are essentially mathematical placeholders inserted into equations to prevent the theories from collapsing.
They are modern epicycles. You know, I was reading about the history of astronomy, and back when everyone thought the Earth was the absolute center of the universe, the math didn't match what they saw in the sky.
The retrograde motion.
Exactly. The planets seemed to move backwards sometimes in weird loops. So instead of admitting the Earth wasn't the center, ancient astronomers like Ptolemy invented epicycles. They added all these crazy, complex, looping mathematical patches to explain the weird orbits. Dark matter and dark energy feel exactly like epicycles. We keep downloading massive, messy software patches to fix a buggy video game engine, rather than admitting the engine itself is fundamentally flawed.
That is an incredibly astute historical parallel. And just like the epicycles, as our telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope and the Planck satellite have become infinitely more precise, the mathematical patches are failing.
The data is just too good now.
Yes. The math is matching the telescope data less and less. The Cantata paper catalogs these failures as severe observational tensions. The most famous and stressful of these is the H-naught tension, or the Hubble tension.
This one is fascinating because it's so basic. The Hubble tension is basically an argument over how fast the universe is expanding. But why is it a tension? Why can't they just agree on the speed?
Because we have two different, highly reliable ways to measure that speed, and they give us violently conflicting answers.
Okay, what's the first way?
The first method looks at the early universe. We measure the cosmic microwave background, the ancient radiation left over from the Big Bang. We plug that data into standard Lambda CDM math, and it predicts a specific slower rate of expansion for the universe today.
Okay, so that's the prediction based on the ancient past. What's the second method?
The second method measures the local, present-day universe directly. Astronomers look at specific pulsating stars called Cepheid variables and supernovae in nearby galaxies.
Right.
When we measure the actual physical expansion happening around us right now, it is expanding significantly faster than the early universe math says it should be. The error bars on these two measurements no longer overlap. They definitively contradict each other.
And it's not just the expansion rate. There's also the sigma 8 tension, right? What is that one?
The sigma 8 tension deals with how matter clumps together. Standard gravity predicts that as the universe ages, matter should clump together into vast cosmic webs of galaxies at a specific rate.
Okay.
But when we actually map the galaxies using weak gravitational lensing, we find that matter is clustering together significantly slower and is more smoothly distributed than Einstein's rules say it should be.
So to stick with our video game analogy, the physics engine is rendering the map too fast and the objects in the map are sticking together too slowly.
Exactly.
The game is breaking. So what is the physics community doing about this? According to the Cantata paper, they are desperately trying to hack the fundamental DNA of gravity to fix the code.
Yes. In theoretical physics, the fundamental mathematical equation that dictates how a theory behaves is called its action. It is the DNA. The DNA of general relativity is called the Einstein-Hilbert action. And this entire action relies heavily on one single variable, the Ricci scalar, which is denoted mathematically as R.
And what does the Ricci scalar actually represent in the physical world?
The Ricci scalar is a mathematical tool that measures the continuous, smooth curvature of spacetime. Einstein said that matter tells spacetime how to curve, and the curve of spacetime tells matter how to move. That curve is R.
Got it.
The Cantata network catalogs the four main theoretical schemes that physicists are using to rewrite that DNA to mess with R in order to fix these cosmic cracks without relying on dark matter.
Let's walk through these four ways they are trying to patch the engine because they get progressively more radical. Scheme one is essentially adding extra physics on top of Einstein. The paper calls it the plus one approach.
Right.
Einstein said the geometry of space-time is the only thing responsible for gravity. But these new theories, like scalar tensor theories or Horn-Desky theories, suggest there's a missing ingredient. They propose an invisible universe-spanning field similar to the Higgs field that interacts with space-time to dictate how gravity behaves over massive galactic distances.
Yes. And then scheme two is what we might call a math upgrade. It focuses on higher order curvature. Instead of assuming gravity scales perfectly linearly with a simple curvature R, what if the math is exponentially more complicated?
Okay, so making the equation harder.
Exactly. What if gravity is a function of R, a theory called FR, gravity? This involves adding complex terms like R squared or cubed into the fundamental DNA.
And why does adding an exponent like squared or cubed help?
It seems like a minor tweak on a chalkboard, but in the physical universe, adding that R squared term naturally generates the repulsive force needed to explain the rapid expansion of the universe.
Oh, I see.
It produces the effects of dark energy purely through geometry, without needing to invent a brand new, undetectable phantom energy.
That makes sense. Tweak the math, fix the expansion. But scheme three is the one that really blows my mind. It's about changing the fundamental geometry itself, what they call the geometrical trinity.
Yes, this is where it gets very interesting.
Because Einstein built his entire theory on Riemannian geometry, which dictates that space can bend and curve like a trampoline, but it does not tear and it does not twist. The curvature is everything. But the Cantata researchers are exploring completely alien geometries.
They are exploring the other two pillars of the trinity. The first is teleperlal gravity. In this model, spacetime has absolutely zero curvature. It doesn't bend like a trampoline at all. Instead, it twists.
It twists.
Gravity is modeled as a torsional force, acting mathematically, much more like electromagnetism than traditional gravity.
So matter doesn't fall into a curved dent. It gets pulled into a geometric twist.
Correct.
And what's the other pillar?
Symmetric teleperlal gravity. In this framework, space doesn't curve and it doesn't twist. Instead, it stretches. The actual physical length of a ruler would change depending on where you move it through space and in what direction. This property is called non-metricity.
Which is so hard to picture, the idea that the very definition of an inch or a meter changes depending on gravitational fields.
It defies common sense, certainly.
Yeah. But what is truly wild about Scheme 3 is that physicists have proven you can mathematically recreate Einstein's exact predictions for our solar system using twisting space or stretching space instead of curving space. It opens up entirely new avenues to solve the galactic mysteries without violating what we already know works locally.
Which brings us to the final approach, Scheme 4 quantizing gravity. General relativity fundamentally assumes space-time is a continuous, perfectly smooth, infinitely divisible sheet.
Right.
But quantum mechanics, the other most successful theory in human history, tells us that the microscopic world is not smooth. It is pixelated. It is quantized into discrete packets of energy. Theories in Scheme 4, like loop quantum gravity, attempt to break space-time itself down into discrete fundamental building blocks at the unimaginably tiny Planck scale.
So with all these different theories twisting space, R-squared math, pixelated space, how do physicists figure out which patch actually works? They have to use observational telescope data as a ruthless filter to kill off the bad theories, right?
Exactly. For example, any theory of modified gravity has to explain why gravity seems perfectly normal here on Earth, but acts weirdly on a galactic scale.
Okay, how do they do that?
To do this, theorists invent screening mechanisms. These are mathematical tricks embedded in the equations that basically hide the modified gravity in areas of high density like our solar system, but let the modified gravity turn on in the massive, empty voids of deep space.
The data is completely ruthless, though. The best example of data killing a theory happened in 2017. Astronomers detected a neutron star collision, an event called GW17878.
A monumental day in astrophysics.
Truly. For the first time ever, we detected the gravitational waves rippling through space-time from the collision, and we also saw the actual flash of light from the explosion.
And here's the kicker. The gravitational wave and the light wave traveled for 130 million light years,
yeah,
and they hit our detectors on Earth at the exact same fraction of a second.
It was an extinction event for hundreds of theoretical models. Because they arrived simultaneously, it definitively empirically proved that gravity travels at exactly the speed of light. Right.
Any modified gravity theory in the four schemes that predicted gravity traveled even a fraction of a percent faster or slower than light was instantly thrown in the trash. The data is narrowing the field drastically.
The Cantata paper concludes by saying, we are not at the end of general relativity, but rather we are at the end of the beginning. They know with absolute certainty that a massive paradigm shift is coming.
They do.
Which perfectly sets the stage for our final and most profound set of sources. Because what if the answer isn't to keep downloading messy software patches like dark matter or adding extra math fields or twisting space? What if the solution is to throw out the buggy video game engine entirely, format the hard drive, and rewrite the source code of reality from scratch?
This brings us to the Newellian Universe Theory, or KUT, developed over several decades by David Noel Lynch.
Yes, KUT.
And to understand KUT, we have to understand the specific, deeply philosophical problem it aims to solve. Lynch's framework was born out of a profound personal experience, a near-death experience in 1977, but he formalized it through his background in computer science and systems architecture in the early 1990s.
That's a unique angle.
It is. He approaches physics not just as equations on a chalkboard, but as information processing.
And through that computer science lens, Lynch argues that modern physics is fundamentally irreparably broken because it is built upon a flawed ancient Greek concept, the dimensionless point.
What KUT refers to as the Platonic Rift, orthodox physics currently treats space as a continuous, infinitely divisible void made up of geometric points. But by mathematical definition, a point has zero dimensions. It has no length, no width, no depth. It is infinitely small.
And Lynch points out a glaring logical error here that we just accept blindly. You cannot build a real physical 3D universe out of building blocks that possess zero dimensions.
You can't.
It's like trying to build a Lego castle using Legos that don't exist. When you try to build a universe out of zeros, your math inevitably breaks down and creates impossible infinities.
Those infinities are the bane of modern physics. When you use dimensionless points, your equations eventually divide by zero, resulting in a singularity.
Right.
This is why general relativity breaks down at the center of a black hole, predicting infinite density. It is why it breaks down at the Big Bang, predicting all matter emerged from an infinitely small point. Infinities are nature's way of telling physicists their math is wrong.
To fix this, KUT states that we must throw away the dimensionless point entirely. We must start with a fundamental building block of reality that actually possesses physical size, no matter how small.
Yeah, exactly.
Space is not an empty, continuous container. It is a quantized, pixelated grid. It is made entirely of discrete architectural units that Lynch calls the six-dimensional event point.
The event point.
And the most radical claim of this entire framework is that space and time are not just connected like threads in a fabric. They are the exact same thing. Space is made of time.
Let's break down the dimensions of this event point, because this is where the actual operating system of the universe comes into view. In KUT, the dimensions aren't just spatial directions like up, down, left, and right. The dimensions are temporal states.
Temporal states, okay.
Depth is defined as the past. It is the accumulated memory and structural history of the universe, which acts as a rigid control field. Length is defined as the future. It is the infinite field of unmanifested potential, randomness, and chaos.
And width. Width is the instant. It is the precise, fleeting present moment, which KUT defines unequivocally as consciousness itself.
And inside every single one of these quantized event points is a highly specific topological geometry. A 3-2 torus knot.
Okay, I have to stop and visualize this. What is a torus knot and why does a knot even matter?
A torus is mathematically a donut shape. A 3-2 torus knot is a continuous loop that winds around the surface of that donut, looping through the center twice and around the outside three times before connecting back to itself.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
In KUT, this knot isn't just a shape, it acts as an engine. It is the thermodynamic site where the outward flowing, solidifying past literally crashes into the inward collapsing chaotic future.
Imagine two massive rivers of data colliding head-on inside a circular pipe. The sheer thermodynamic friction, the turbulence of that collision between past and future, is what generates the spark of the present moment.
That's it, exactly.
The universe isn't a mechanical clockwork ticking away in a dead void. It's a holographic optical computer. Reality is literally being rendered frame by frame, pixel by pixel at the speed of light.
PayUT introduces a specific computational architecture for this rendering process called POMM, parallel optical matrix-matrix multiplication. The cosmic computer constantly calculates what should happen next by multiplying the memory of the past against the potential of the future across every pixel of space simultaneously.
Okay. We need to explain the computer science behind this, specifically the big O notation, because it explains why Einstein's math is failing. The KUT rendering architecture is O of N parallel processing. What does that mean for the listener?
In computer science, big O notation describes how an algorithm scales. An O of N algorithm scales linearly.
Okay.
If you have 10 items to calculate, it takes 10 units of time. If you have a billion items, it takes a billion units. It is efficient and predictable. Orthodox physics, however, relies on continuous O of n squared calculus.
Which scales quadratically. If you have 10 items, it takes 100 units of time.
Exactly. In standard gravity, every single piece of matter theoretically pulls on every other piece of matter in the universe simultaneously. If you try to run that as a simulation to calculate the gravitational relationship between every atom and every other atom, an O of n squared algorithm results in a combinatorial explosion.
It crashes.
It creates a rendering deadlock. The computer freezes. The universe would freeze.
Lynch recognized that a functional universe cannot operate on O of N squared calculus. It's too computationally heavy. So gravity cannot be a magical pulling force bending a continuous sheet of rubber. Instead, gravity is governed by an algorithm called the fast multipole method, or FMM. It is an O of N memory efficient algorithmic lookup table.
A lookup table, yes.
So what does this all mean practically? If the universe is a massive optical computer rendering reality through a lookup table, where is the hard drive? Where is the memory actually stored?
The memory is stored in what Keiji calls the CRAM, the Noetherian Resonant Attractor Manifold. Think of the CRAM as the physical geometric floor of the universe. Every time an event is rendered in the present moment, it etches a microscopic physical groove into the CRAM.
So over time, the universe forms habits.
Precisely.
This is the crux of the whole theory. Heavy objects like stars and planets don't curve a continuous sheet of space-time. They carve incredibly deep memory grooves into the quantized CRAM. Other objects, like a comet flying into the solar system, naturally curve toward the star not because they're being pulled, but simply because it is computationally easier for the universe's rendering engine to route the comet's path into those pre-existing memory grooves. It is literally the computational path of least resistance.
Let's apply this CRAM architecture to solve the massive crisis in cosmology we discussed earlier, the H-naught tension, the dark sector. Lambda CDM dictates there was a single Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago.
Right.
KUT states emphatically that there was no single Big Bang.
Right.
The universe is not expanding outward from one central ancient explosion.
Because if reality is a matrix of event points, then mini-bangs are happening everywhere, all the time, at every single pixel of space, as reality is continuously rendered frame by frame.
And instantly, the necessity for the dark sector vanishes. Dark energy is no longer a mysterious phantom force accelerating the universe. It is simply the outward geometric pressure of the past, the control field. As more and more history is rendered into solid existence, it takes up memory space, pushing the grid outward.
And dark matter is no longer an invisible particle hiding from our detectors. Dark matter is the gravitational pull of the future, the chaos field. It is the literal thermodynamic weight of potential things that haven't happened yet, pulling inward on the present rendering moment. We don't need patches for the video game anymore. The KUT engine renders it perfectly.
And what about the cosmic microwave background? Standard physics asserts the CMB is the leftover heat from the ancient Big Bang, cooling down over 13 billion years. KUT completely recontextualizes it.
How so?
The CMB is the processing heat of the cosmic computer right now. It is the immediate thermodynamic friction of the past and future colliding in the present moment across the entire sky.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this geometric framework provides an ultimate checkmate to what physicists openly call the embarrassment of the standard model. And we have to talk about the free parameters, because this is where physics usually throws its hands up in defeat. What is a free parameter?
Currently, orthodox physics requires about 26 free parameters to function. You can think of these as magic numbers, foundational constants like the mass of an electron, the fine structure constant, the gravitational constant, the speed of light.
Okay.
Physics cannot mathematically explain why these numbers are what they are. There is no underlying theory that derives them. We simply have to measure them with instruments, write them down, and plug them into our equations by hand, like volume knobs on the universe.
And because physicists can't explain why our universe is so perfectly, precisely fine-tuned with these exact numbers, because if the electron mass was even slightly different, atoms wouldn't form and we wouldn't exist, they came up with the multiverse cop-out.
Yes, driven largely by the failure of string theory. To find a single predictable vacuum state, theorists declared, well, there must be an infinite number of universes bubbling into existence with completely random numbers.
Right.
We just got incredibly lucky to be in the one universe where the random roll of the dice allowed for stars, carbon, and biology. It is deeply unsatisfying philosophically and scientifically.
But KUT destroys the need for a multiverse by proposing a model built on 25 zero-free parameter derivations, or ZFPDs. Lynch doesn't plug in numbers by hand. He starts purely with geometry.
Yes, geometry is the foundation.
By placing that rational 3-2 torus knot onto an irrational geometric floor called the Cairo-Q lattice, which is a specific pentagonal tiling pattern that fills space seamlessly, Lynch calculated the absolute thermodynamic friction of the universe. He calls it the Noellian offset.
And from that single, inescapable geometric friction, the model automatically derives the exact numbers for the fundamental constants without plugging in any arbitrary data. It calculates the exact proton to electron mass ratio. It calculates the fine structure constant. It calculates the gravitational constant, all purely from the geometry of the lattice.
It proves that the universe isn't random. The mass of an electron is a mathematical inevitability dictated entirely by the shape of the geometric space it occupies. It throws the multiverse theory in the trash because the universe must be exactly the way it is based on its underlying pixelated geometry.
Of course, in the scientific method, deriving things we already know, like the mass of an electron, is impressive. But for a new paradigm to overthrow general relativity, it must make a falsifiable prediction.
Right. It has to be testable.
It must predict something we do not know yet and risk being proven wrong. And KUT issues a very specific falsifiable ultimatum.
Yes. The CMB prediction. KUT predicts that if astrophysicists take the massive data sets from the Planck satellite mapping the cosmic microwave background, and they analyze that heat map using advanced topological data analysis, they will not see random Gaussian thermal noise like the standard model predicts.
KUT guarantees that they will see the distinct geometric signature of the Cairo-pentagonal tiling. That is a hard, testable prediction. Look at the CMB, run the topological filter, find the pentagons. If you find them, you prove definitively that the universe is running on a discrete geometric floor.
And if that is proven, the applied mechanics of this theory border on pure science fiction, yet they are entirely, rigorously, logically consistent within the framework. Because if you know the code, you can hack the code. Lynch outlines something called the VM drive, or temporal cramcraft.
It is macroscopic propulsion by overriding the local latency field.
What does that mean exactly?
If gravity is just an algorithmic memory lookup table in the cram, You don't need to burn thousands of tons of chemical rocket fuel to push a ship through empty space.
You don't push at all. You actively spoof the floor's memory. You use electromagnetic frequencies to freeze the local vacuum, pay the geometric friction cost to forge a new memory groove in the cram, and you essentially fall upward. You change your coordinate address in the universe by rewriting the memory of the space around you.
It is a breathtaking unification of physics and information theory. And this, finally, is exactly where we must connect the massive cosmic architecture of the Nolan universe back to the wet microscopic biology of the human brain we discussed in the very first hour.
Yes, let's bring this all the way full circle. We started by looking at those tiny 25 nanometer microtubule nanowires inside your neurons. We saw that they are not just biological scaffolding. They act as fractal, scale-free quantum antennas, vibrating in a highly complex nested triplet of triplet mathematical pattern.
In the orthodox classical view of biology, those quantum vibrations are just an isolated biological anomaly, a weird quirk of proteins. But viewed through the lens of KUT, the human being takes on a cosmic significance.
It really does.
In KUT, the human brain is defined as a sovereign fractal processor. The fractal resonance inside your microtubules is not biological static. It is the physical brain acting as a literal tuned antenna plugging directly into the universe's carom.
Your consciousness isn't an illusion created by firing neurons in a dark skull. Consciousness is the instant field. It is the width dimension of the event point. It's the precise localized phase boundary where the infinite chaotic potential of the future is compressed and rendered into the solid, permanent memory of the past.
We are not accidental Boltzmann brains flickering into a meaningless existence in a cold, dead void. We are the fractional feedback loop.
I love that phrase.
We are the active error correction code of the cosmos. Our microtubule networks allow the universe to localize, perceive, and optimize its own rendering process.
Here's where it gets really interesting, and this is what I want you, the listener, to mull over as you go about your day. I want to ground this massive physics concept in your actual reality. If the universe fundamentally relies on a memory substrate, the cram, where repeated events carve permanent physical grooves into the geometry of reality, well, making it computationally easier for that exact same event, that exact same choice, to happen again in the future.
Then your choices are not strictly personal, isolated events. Ethics, morality, and behavior become actual thermodynamic laws of physics.
Exactly. I cannot stop thinking about this. Every single thought you have, every action you take, every ethical choice you make is actively laying down the architectural track for the future of the cosmos. If you act with compassion, you are literally carving a groove of compassion into the cram, making it computationally easier for the next person to fall into that same behavior.
It's a profound responsibility.
It is. Just like a broken arm shows up as a jagged white line on an X-ray, your consciousness is leaving a structural imprint on the geometry of space and time. You are the universe rendering itself. So the only question left for you is, what grooves are you carving today?